Dave Monk, Prairie Monk, WEFT, Champagne, 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. This would be July the 2nd. We're 2 days away from Independence Day. And you're tuned to the Prairie Monk, WEFT's weekly look at the environment and rails and trails and greenways and whatever else Dave is in the mood for this week, including having a guest today.
Well, first of all, remember that WEFT has a float in the parade, and Bill Sadler's putting together. And we need people to ride their bicycles, walk, and sort of communicate with people. They have a nice little house on the top of a trailer and a prime mover to move it. So Yes. And the Heartland Pathways has a parade vehicle too. It'll be simple, with a picture of roadside prairies and a few statements. So we'll put that together probably Monday night or Monday afternoon. And we have a guest, and it's Bruce Han. And he's a local also. We do a lot of things on this program to talk about local. And one of the things I did this week, David had me to go to the Blind Pig. And so helped me. I was meeting all sorts of people there. And I met one person named Scott. And I forget his other name, but he's an engineer at the Illini Union. So we started talking about the clock of the Illini Union. And that reminded me that Bruce was is a clock repairer. And he's had a lot to do with the county clock. So we talked about that. And then there was John, who has a CD, and the picture on the front is of the little pocket prairie. Daniel McCollum came by, and Mike Ledoux came by, and there were people from the pipe shop, and all that sort of interaction was good. And then a little later, Gretchen called. She'd taken an interest in compass plants and the like, and I thought she ought to take a walk around the Big Dig, so we'll talk about the Big Dig. But all this is interaction. You go to the farmer's market, you find John Dunkelberg, who has just come back yesterday from a trip from Vladivostok to Moscow.
Is that John who used to be a librarian at Urbana?
That's right, yes.
So people may remember him, yes, tallish guy, yes. Graying, salt and pepper hair, and if you were ever at the Urbana Free Library, you probably saw John.
Yes, and just talking to people, somebody there. We were getting 30-odd miles of rare bed from Bloomington to Farmer City to Mansfield, and that will be a rail trail. It's just been abandoned by Norfolk Southern, but they haven't abandoned the piece between Mansfield and Champaign, because it's a heavy grain line, and Cargill takes its grain out there and switches onto another railroad line that goes north and south. So we're trying to figure out how to go through the back blocks on small roads with and get to Champaign and get to perhaps Mattis Avenue. You can do it. So we're trying to make that connection between Bloomington and Champaign. So just all these sorts of discussions are good and healthy, and we encourage you to do the same. And especially I want you to go to the Big Dig and have a look at the prairie. And in the background, congratulate the city for having landscaped a big hole in the ground, which is the detention pond. We'll talk about that a little later. But they've landscaped it in an interesting way with native plants. And okay, well, yeah, and David had a problem last week. I had mentioned that we could people in the 50s would use a 56 Chevy to run along the railroad bed. And so help me, I went to the idea store, and there was a 56 Chevy all ready to go. And I talked to the people who were dealing with older cars, and they like to communicate with older people, because they're young enough that they don't know some of the details of older cars. But yes, if you had a railroad bed that was not being used, you could put your car on that and take a six pack and have a rider's time for a while. We're not teaching people to do that. It was interesting that you could. So let's introduce Bruce. Bruce grew up in Ivesdale. He's had his finger in a lot of pies. He's part engineer, part geographer, and part local conservationist. He plants trees. He has been involved with the Oakley Reservoir, and he's interested in the Sangamon River Corridor, which is from Fisher down to Mahomet, down to Monticello, to Allerton Park, down to Decatur. So let's have Bruce say something about how he grew up and how he got into all this.
Well, it was a long time ago. Isaiah was a more self-sufficient community in those days. He very seldom needed to go to Champaign for anything. Three grocery stores, three taverns as well. But much more dependent internally than now.
It was an elevated town.
It was a grain. It was an agricultural focused town for sure.
And they were about 5 miles apart.
Yeah, 5-6 miles apart, and there are the grain elevators. That's right, and along the Wabash Railroad, as it was named at the time, and that was a big thing in a young person's life. We used to admire the power of the steam engine, for sure.
Yes.
My brother and I would grease the tracks when the engine was on the siding and cause him to use his sand to get moving. Things like that.
Well, let me tell you that in Australia we knew the song in the Wabash Cannonball.
I'll be darned.
And it was interesting to stand on the tracks where the Wabash Cannonball came through, and then later the historic train came through Tolono on the Wabash.
Right. Well, yes, Great Western and then the Wabash, and now what is it? Norfolk and Southern, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. But it's still a very active railroad. And yet the main support for a town that size were the people who lived on the farms in the surrounding area and who went to church in the town and school in the town. And, of course, that's all disappeared as we've capitalized agriculture so greatly. So most of these small towns are declining in population unless they're like Monticello, a kind of bedroom.
Well, they do things like antique stores and various other things like computerized things, so they're coming back a little bit.
It's possible. Let's hope so. Anyway, I think Isdale at its peak was 650. It's probably 250 now. So I don't know. They got a long way to come back.
Was it Irish?
It was not in the very beginning, but my great-grandfather came in 1850s from the Ottawa area. They came over from Ireland and 1848, but stayed after up the Hudson, across the Great Lakes, and down the Illinois Canal to Ottawa and LaSalle, and worked there, and then moved on down as the railroads came through, moved on down to where they recognized the farm ground as very good. And so they tried farming, but the only land available in those days was wetland. And so you couldn't really farm it. So he started all these businesses in town. He started a grain elevator, sold horses, sold buggies and farm equipment and lumber, salt, coal, seed, you name it. Everything but groceries.
So you're fairly near to Sedoris, which is a similar little town.
Yes, different religion. And that was always a German Lutheran versus Irish Catholic. That was always quite a reason for combat if you needed one. And so that was it. A very enclosed community. Both my parents were grade school teachers, so there was nothing you could pull that they hadn't seen before. So fairly strong discipline.
Well, you grew up in the area and you married at St. Boniface.
Yes, I married someone who has a similar kind of background, all Irish background. So our children are, if they want to claim it, they're all Irish descent. Uh-huh. Yeah. In any event.
Have you been back to Ireland to find out where you came from?
Oh, sure. But my aunt had already done it, so. Uh-huh. Yeah. But I visited those places, yeah. The thing that really turned me into an environmentalist was the dredging of the, we call it a ditch now, but it was the waterway. And it went around two sides of Ivesdale. And it had first been dredged around 1910.
This was the Kaskaskia?
No, it's a branch of the Kaskaskia.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and they dredged it in 1910 for the first time. And then the agricultural depression in the 20s, and then the Great Depression in the 30s, and then the war in the 40s, the trees grew up along this thing, and that was what we knew were that creek, as we call it, with trees. Well, of course, it was a ditch with trees, and in 1959, they dredged it completely, tore out all the trees, and so it's a tremendous shock to me, and turned me against that idea of dredging, just rushing the water off your property onto your neighbor's property.
And down the Mississippi into the
Mississippi
Gulf.
Your ag chemicals go with it, and since they're off your land, you don't care. But unless you're downstream, of course, you care, and you have to then dredge your part of the river and so on and so forth.
And it causes flooding sometimes, too.
Causes downstream flooding. It causes a lot of cities to use very costly nitrate removal devices and chemical ag chemical removal processes.
So how did your grandfather dredge the ditch in the first place? Did he use horses?
Oh, he didn't do it. He didn't do it. These were all...
contractual.
Sure, and it wasn't anything he was in favor of particularly, although the land he had his eye on was too wet to farm until the drainage districts were formed, and that's when the ditches got dredged. That's around the turn of the century, or even some places a little earlier than that. And then in 1910, he was certainly here. He owned land then that was this former wetland, and it's rated now as the most productive.
Yes,
Drummer Flanagan Soils, the most productive farmland going. So all you had to do is wait.
You're very near to Amish territory, too.
Not terribly
about
far.
About 10 miles to the south.
That's right.
You're starting to get Amish.
We had an Amish girl working at our house when my wife was having one of our children, and I'd drive down to Arthur and pick her up every Sunday evening and take her home every Friday evening. It was it was quite a thing how mature they were and self-sufficient. It was surprising. And how free of electricity in most of the modern world. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. There's self-sufficiency for you.
Yes. they're very economically
appropriate
people.
Right. Well, but that dredging of the ditch is what turned me into an environmentalist. I didn't know it at the time. I knew I was outraged by it, but I didn't know what to do about it. It was all done. And of course, it's happening all over the country. The recovery from the war, the economy's improving, the 50s, everybody's got tax. Every agency has plenty of tax revenue. And so they're out moving, paving the roads, dredging the ditches in this area, of course. And then comes the 1967, when I was a grad student at the university here in engineering. And we didn't have a lot of income, so we would go to the 4-H camp in the summer for a week.
That was the University Alden Park 4-H camp.
But the 4-H camp, at the end of the 4-H season, turned into a family camp. And it was a week long, and it was great. There were like 195 people there, and they kept the staff from the 4-H part, and really was very nice. And so my wife, Pat, takes a walk, wanted to know if I wanted to go, and I said, no, I've been there many, many times all my life. And she takes this walk. She comes back, and she says, you know what they're going to do to that river, that park? She had taken the walk with the right guy. And so here was the beginning then of the Corps of Engineers proposal. I didn't even recognize her. She was preaching and talking and bonfires and petitions throughout this week. And on the way home, she said, well, now it's yours. For the next 8 years, it was mine. And increasingly so. And I remember looking at times to see, I'm becoming this environmentalist, not this engineer. Do I really want to do this? I know this is almost in the opposite direction in many cases. And yes, I did it. And I took the step and changed several other people along the way.
Yes, from, you had some academics like Britt Bliss and others that were looking at this.
And engineers like Clark Bullard,
yes,
of course, you know, famous environmentalist today, and many others who've come and gone. And
you even had events where William O. Douglas came.
Supreme Court Justice Douglas came. John Gregg Allerton, who was the heir to the Allerton estate, came. Of course, they given the park and a lot of farmland to support it in the 40s, and had moved to Hawaii.
Gave it to the university.
Gave it to the university, right. And the university didn't exactly manage it well until recently, which is now, if you know anything about it, is just a central place for music, recreation, all sorts of things. It's being very well handled.
The park has been divided into the farmlands and the
income from the trust that the farmland is in now, the University Trust, supports the park. That was a big improvement. It steadies the income. In the first 50 years or so of that park, you relied on the sale of the money from the crops. Yeah, which would be up and down. But when you put the land into the trust, just an accounting change, they figure your certain percentage of the trust and the income from the trust is distributed on that basis. And here it is, a great deal more and steady to the park.
So right. Explain to people who might not know the extent of the damming that was proposed.
Went
up French Creek and...
Yes, well, they first proposed it in the 30s, and it was shot down along with a whole host of dams the Corps had proposed at that time. And they came back with this one because Decatur had felt they needed water, and so they decided they would hold a referendum to build a big dam for water supply on Long Creek, which is a tributary to the Sangamon, but it comes in at Mount Zion, which is right next to Decatur. And they would have used that water, but the city voted it down 2-3-1. I read all the Decatur papers from the 20s till the time when we started on this. I knew more about what went on in Decatur than any other individual over there, especially with regard to things like the water supply. And that was really fundamental to be able to be an effective voice against this dam. For one thing, after 1970, we found, we talked to the industrial people over there, ADM and at the time, Staley's management. We said, do you really need this water? And they said, no, as soon as the environmental laws came in, the city could not dump into the Sangamon, practically raw sewage. And they were the sole flow in the summertime in the Sangamon below Decatur. They couldn't do this anymore, so they were charging us to discharge our waste into the sewage treatment plant. And we decided, we did a cost analysis and figured we could recycle our water and clean it up, and it's actually better than the water we're buying from Lake Decatur. So we did that, and I talked to the other the heads of the other company, they did it too. So the big water users in the community didn't need it. They were recycling. And yet nobody in Decatur is talking about that, right?
Well, the strange thing is that Decatur gets a lot of its water from the aquifer underneath at Monticello and puts it into open drains and picks up nitrogen and phosphorus. And
One of the things that we tried to do, among many, many things we did in the 67 to 75 period, when the 8 years it took to stop this dam proposal, incidentally, we stopped them all across the country shortly after that because of all the connections you made during that time. People were coming from all over the country to see how we were doing, how we were stopping this one. And so it was like a patented process, practically, and don't do this, do this, so on, sort of idea. Here's how to talk to the Corps, how to handle the Corps. They quit building dams all across the country. They had one in every congressional district. And it was a kind of keep busy, keep the House and Senate satisfied with the pork barrel and so on. They were a strong part of that affair. Not so much anymore. They're active on the river And so on. But on the Mississippi River and Ohio River, yeah.
That's mainly for transportation.
Barge transportation, which is, of course, the thing of the past, really, except that they subsidize it so much that it's still here. So anyway, talking to the Corps throughout all this was an important feature. And among all many, many different kinds of things. But the Corps had proposed it in the 30s. Then when the vote failed for the Long Creek Reservoir in Decatur, the city turned to the Corps and said, hey, you know, you remember that dam you once proposed back in the 30s? This is in the 60s then. Still authorized, the Corps said, we can go right ahead with it. Well, so they do, and they start to evaluate it again and find out that it's economically infeasible, and unless they make it bigger. Well, it was already big enough to harm Allerton Park, but now it was going to take about half the park out. So that was our main goal, our dream, to stop it because of that and protect the park. And as a result, we protected most of the Sangamon River because the fall on the river, that is the slope of the river, is 1 foot per mile. It's a very flat river. Yeah, so you build a 30-foot reservoir, water deep on the Sangamon, that you're going up the stream 30 miles. And you're going clear past Monticello with this stagnant water from the reservoir. Well, we had organized the staff people at the university, the faculty, in the various areas that we thought would be important, put together a book called The Battle for the Sangamon. We had water supply experts, economists, even artists writing poetry on the whole thing and the beauty of the park and so on. Very thorough, and eventually just overcame the Corps of Engineers, although nobody thought we could do it.
And I think the Corps was very disappointed because they were thinking a major construction here.
That's right. They, as I said, they have this keep busy syndrome, right? There's 33,000 of them in those years and about 400 Corps officers. And the officers were the sort of authoritative covering for this pork barrel operation. I often thought at the time it was even part of how the defense budget got so many votes, right? Because here's the Corps, they're in the Department of Defense, you want the defense budget to be bigger and go through, greased by pork. And I thought that was the case, although I never really saw any real proof of that. Well, anyway, in 75 it was over, the greatest collection of politicians of different levels, and all we needed was the President of the United States, and we would have filled it out. We had the head of the Corps of Engineers from Washington. We had both federal senators, state senators, because there were two involved in that, all the state reps, the governor, I think it was Walker at the time, and all their staffs. And they had come into Springfield to make an announcement. We had gotten Senator Percy, much to his surprise, we had gotten it through that he would ask the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, to do a study of the proposed dam. And they come back with a study to Percy. It has to be from a senator before they do anything. Of course, as soon as we got the signed letter, we were off to see the Congressional Budget Office and talk to them about it. They come out just as strong against it as you can imagine. And so Senator Percy has to go through with it then, and his idea was to organize this collection of politicians and staff people in Springfield to announce the death of the Oakley Reservoir proposal. And everybody in the room says, yes, 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 yes. I'm the only one who hadn't formally been in favor of the project. So it's like 1 to 25 or something like that. So they go around and ask everybody, yes, yes, it's dead. And Bruce, yeah. I said, well, we'll see. These things have a way of coming back, you know. And so then Percy says, but, you know, we really have to help Decatur. They need the water and the water supply. And, of course, we shot that idea down many times. And they said, well, so what we're going to do is build a dam on Friends Creek, Well, because of the connections we had with all these offices, senators, Corps of Engineers. Corps of Engineers in Chicago would put out a publication, and the printer they went to would give it to us before he gave it back to the Corps. We were that far infiltrated into this process. So we knew ahead of time, had press releases already when the Corps goes to announce this, everything, we were ready. And the same was true of this French Creek Dam proposal, because there were people from Argenis, the French Creek area, all over the place. Two guys, famously, with a pitchfork woven through the tines of the fork, stopped the dam. And they looked rather desperate, went AP, sent it all over the country. It was a famous photograph.
Sort of a Grant Woods.
Yes, it was like a Grant Woods. Yes, it was a beautiful picture. And so they asked me, they went around and said, yeah, everybody's in favor of this fringe group. Said, okay, Bruce, how about you? I said, didn't you see all the people you had to step over to just get into this room? Yeah. Don't you understand opposition to these things? And no matter how much power you tend to put behind it, it isn't going to work. The real problem is Lake Decatur's filling with silt. It was a mistake to have built it where it is in the first place. They could have built on a tributary, been much better off. But now it's filling with silt, and that's the real problem here. And you're trying to build something that traps silt and keeps it out of Decatur, Lake Decatur. What? You know, what sense is it? And besides that, the industry say they're recycling and they don't really need the water. And so what are we talking about here? And as it turned out, that was just a political flare to propose this French Creek Reservoir, because it didn't never heard of it again. So that was the end of it, except that after that, we stopped all the reservoirs in the proposals the Corps had in the country, and we got them deauthorized, taken completely off the books. That was the final step. And Congressman Ed Madigan, who was against the Oakley Reservoir, who was a wonderful help and a great politician. He was the one who put in the deauthorizing legislation for all these dams.
So just to clarify, the problem you'd run into before was there was still the thing in the books that said, hey, just make it, do it better.
That's right.
And this time he said, no, we're not doing it this time, and you can't come back and say later, let's do it.
That's okay. Right. Well, they can, but they have to go through an authorization process. You don't have it on the books. When you get it authorized, you lock in the current interest rate, which in the Depression was very low.
Yes.
And that makes it very easy to justify the project in their mind. But they had cooked up a whole lot of benefits.
The interest rate was a big deal.
Interest rate was a big deal, and they had it locked in from the 30s because that's when the project was first authorized. Mm-hmm. And that's why we got it deauthorized, taken, in a sense, with a scalpel out of the core memory. All right.
So have continued that interest.
Oh, yes.
One of the things about the rivers, Sangamon included, was that you had polders. You had a levee built on the edge of the bottomlands.
Oh, my gosh,
And then you could pump the water out that came off the landscape.
That's right.
And you could plant your crops in that area or graze your cattle.
And what they were doing on the Sangamon was this. Farmers knew they couldn't graze a crop on the bottomlands. It flooded too often. It was great soil because for years they'd been farming on the erosion of the farmlands and topsoil of the farmlands is in the bottomland, right? So it was great soil, but it flooded. And so they didn't really largely farm that. These were the places they had farmed in the very beginning, but not in the modern times. So the trees had grown back in the bottoms all along the Sangamon. USDA comes out with a program that says, we'll pay you to not farm, but you have to farm it for 3 years. It has to have been farmed for at least 3 years. So what they did was clear off the bottomlands, try to farm it, got paid for crop failures, and then said, oh, we'd like to put this bottomland ground, this part of my farm, into the program. And what the program did was pay effectively the profit per acre they were getting off their entire farm. Uh-huh. And so the Sangamon was getting stripped just by the ag programs. It was insane. And, you know, trying to stop something like that, the juggernaut of agriculture in this area is phenomenal. So just one more subsidy for agriculture. So we tried to stop them from doing that. We've tried various things. We talked to the Department of Agriculture, and Ed Madigan became Secretary of Agriculture, and that was a big, big improvement then. We got several of the things stopped that they were doing. Yeah, so 1975, I had a 5 years after my PhD, I'm a assistant professor. What's going to happen now? I probably ticked off a huge number of people.
Including the Army.
Army guys didn't matter. That was okay. But the politicians at various places, like Decatur Mayor, would routinely come to the university and want me discharged, right? And they would send me a letter saying the mayor of Decatur has been here and has suggested you are no longer needed at this university. You shouldn't be teaching the kids what you think. And of course, we're not doing anything about that. All right, but they wanted me to know that he'd come.
So in the process, there was a lot of activity in advanced computation.
Yes.
And so there was a lot of protest about the Army being so involved with the university.
Department of Defense, really. Yes, they had funded this first of the parallel processing computers in the 60s. And I got drafted into that movement to show that these big computers could be used for something besides aiming missiles, i.e. the environment. So that was my home for the next 12 years or something like that. And we did research on, our idea was that fossil fuel use, this is where I got Clark Bullard involved and a guy named Herendeen, who was here for many, many years, involved in looking at the fossil fuel use behind every good or service, from the ground to that thing you're holding in your hand or you're driving down the road, right? What does it cost out of the ground whenever a new car is produced, whenever a bus passenger mile is taken, and so on? And we did this for years and became quite famous for it and had tons of money, grant money from the feds. And then Ronald Reagan was elected president in 1980, and that was the end of the big conservation movement. Our idea was that in the use of fossil fuels, besides what's going into the air, the CO2 and so on, the global warming idea was known but to very few people at that time in the 70s. Besides that, the pollution from power plants, for example, was pretty much unmitigated and was dangerous in and of itself. And so everywhere fossil fuels moved, as soon as you brought them out of the ground, in doing so, you strip mines in, say, southern Illinois, for example, which was a mess. And the natural gases that were burned, they emitted some, but less than coal. And oil was another thing with all the cars, all the pollution to the cities. It was a tremendous problem. So our idea was use less fossil fuels and you will disturb the environment less. And we started in the 69 doing that, and 73, I think, was the boycott year. And the price of, I think it was something like three times the price of gasoline went up, a factor of three, and then later a factor of four on top of that. And so everybody's trying to conserve, and that made us the most popular kids on the block. Well, so that was a career.
Was moved out to Searle. It was
The computer was being finished. We never did use it. We never needed it, actually. We were happy with the local supercomputers at the university. Other than that, parallel processing fell out of favor as the transistor made serial computation very cost effective for a while. And then as the demand for bigger and bigger computers and more computer power went on, it came back, but about 20, 30 years later. So we were way ahead of the curve on the parallel processing computer. But the, yes, they did leave dynamite on the front door porch one time, and it went out. And the director thought that was a fairly significant signal, since they had blown up the similar building at Madison, University of Wisconsin, there in the front of the post office in Minneapolis, same summer, that he would move the computer somewhere else. So it went to California.
Was that figurative, or you're talking about literal explosion? I'm sorry. I heard you saying figuratively there was the potential for something to blow up, and
no,
it didn't.
They put that actual dynamite on it.
There was actual dynamite to get rid of this thing.
On the doorstep, right, but it went out. The police came and saw that the fuse had just gone out. Whoever put it there had taken off.
This is serious stuff, folks. I looked out my window one day, and there were Army people with fixed bayonets about 2 feet apart all the way along Springfield Avenue.
Oh, these were the Vietnam protest days, yes. Well, we're not getting to the rest of the environment. We got only 20 minutes left.
Yes. Yeah. Well, so you have saved one of these levee areas, and it's now a farmland associated with a polder or a drained area and a levee along it. And
well, you mean the Land Conservation Foundation?
Yes.
We're trying now to, for years, by the way, I was head of the evolution of the committee we had formed to stop the dam, and it became Central States. Then it took on its current name, the Prairie Rivers Network.
Yes.
And is doing extremely well at that. And I had tried to step away so many, many times, but let's say popular demand made me stay. And eventually, I dropped away from that group, not because of what it was doing. It's doing extremely good stuff, very well. But I had this other idea of starting the development of a corridor along the river, in the bottoms, and getting people out into nature, especially young people, into nature. And we've managed to do that on a trail that's right on the west edge of Monticello. And it is about 2 miles long, all told. And it's on a levee, which is in a circle around the bottomlands that we bought. And the man who did it back in the 30s thought he would mine gravel, and that was the typical thing to do, is build a levee around. And he found that there's nothing but sand under it, so he abandoned that project, and we ended up owning it much later on.
A farming situation.
It had been farmed. There were 60 acres inside this loop. So the trail is really neat in that you can walk on this levee all year long.
Yes.
Right? It's no matter how much it rains, you can walk on this levee, and snow.
And instead of pumping the water out with an Archimedes principle,
they didn't do it. All he was going to do was dig a hole. Uh-huh. And then the farmer took it over. The levee had been breached by the river. He gave up on trying to farm it even. And we bought it and restored we fixed up the levee where it had been broken, but we put through these big 3-foot culverts so the water can come and particularly can get out of this enclosure. And so that's the idea, all along the Sangamon, connect Decatur to Mahomet or even north of there, which brings up the levee question you had raised earlier. On the big rivers, the Mississippi and Ohio, for example, it's what I call the levee wars. The Corps builds these levees to protect the bottomlands of the Mississippi. Now we're talking a grand scale compared to the Sangamon.
The river is sitting higher than the...
The river is higher than the surrounding bottomland, right? And of course, what they're doing when they do that is force the river into a narrow channel. They build the levees right out next to the channel, the normal weather level of the river.
No more floodplain.
No more floodplain. And then the people who are farming on this side don't have a levee as, say, Missouri, don't have a levee as high as the levee on the Illinois side. And so what do? They go to the Corps and they say, look, the levees are higher over here. It's forcing the water over our levees. Because when you force the river into a narrower thing, it gets higher for any given flood. And so they flooded Missouri in the big flood of 93, and they screamed for not 100-year protection, 500-year protection. Mm-hmm. Well, now their levees are higher than the ones in Illinois. Illinois is getting flooded, and so they're screaming about it, and they want 500, but they want 600 because, you know, you never know. So now they're higher, and that's the levee wars as they raise them. The Corps loves this, right? Because they don't really solve the problem. They create the problem. And that's the levee wars that's going on in the river. It's destructive of bottomlands. It's destructive of nature and wildlife and causes farmers to try and farm the places they should never be.
Yes.
Right.
Let's transfer that to a local situation where we have a county that's basically a very damp county.
The Boneyard, are you going to talk about?
Yes.
Yes, let's talk about the Boneyard.
And you have a county that was one of the last to be developed because it was so wet. Mm. And it was drained, but it was not drained as much as people would like. And then you put in houses and streets and you get runoff. Mm-hmm. And so Bruce has been involved in this from a long time ago. I can remember these photographs that you had of the Boneyard in a somewhat more natural state as it went through Scott Park.
Came back in to school in the 65, and it was sort of latent environmentalism, as I said, from the Ivesdale ditch being cleared off. Saw this creek and saw that it flooded and decided to do something about it. So I had student projects where we went around and painted yellow every outlet into the Boneyard, put a stake by it with a number on it and a phone number to call. That was us. We'd run out, the kids would run out and get a sample of whatever it was and take it to the EPA. Well, the water or something.
The
I forgot.
Environmental Protection
Agency. Yeah, it was the former forerunner of the EPA. But they do the sample evaluation, and we'd nail various industries along the way. I remember one time we had the city of Champaign arrested for litter. They would sweep up the streets and pile it over along the Boneyard, and somehow it would magically disappear. And they just would do this as routinely.
I had the same thing happen at Rantoul. There would like a 5-ton truck would be vacuum out the culverts and dump it on what was a remnant prairie.
Yeah. Well, amazing. Anyway, got the city of Champaign arrested and various people along the creek arrested for stuff they threw over the edge of the creek. There's a law that Fish and Wildlife Law that you can't do this, right?
And I had a member of class reading a landscape class, and he had a job of finding out who was doing this, and he would put a bomb in the drain that was coming from the house directly into the drain, and he'd do it at the time when a football game was on, so people were in the house, and the smoke from the bomb would go into the house, and then the fire department would be called up. But at least they knew who was putting water.
Right. That's a good way to do it. Right. The city then really got interested in it, and particularly the city of Urbana, because one of the guys from WBBM TV came down. Did a big show on Allerton. He said, "You got any other environmental issues going on?" I said, "Yes, there's human waste floating down the creek right in the middle of town." Mm. And so we went over to the Kohler Street sewer, and almost on cue, here it comes. And and so Urbana started on WBBM TV, and I don't think they appreciated that at all. But the next thing you know, they are going. It's about $1,000 a house to fix the sanitary sewers. What they had done is put the sewers across each other, like the storm sewer was, say, going this way, the sanitary was going over the top of it, but they were touching. And then gradually they broke between the two. Uh-huh. And so they transferred sanitary waste into the storm sewers. And they had to fix that. And it was an elaborate public works project, but they did it. Good for them.
So it is a big dig, and a lot of people have been involved in the long run.
What?
The end of this is a
big thing. Sure.
You would have people who could row a boat down Green Street in a big flood.
They decided that because, as you mentioned, the watershed of the Boneyard was paved with roads and roofs and driveways to garages and so on, and the water rushed off in, let's say, a rain on the watershed today will peak in the Boneyard at, before they fixed it like it is now, before detention, 45 minutes between the peak of the rainfall and the peak of the flow in the stream. In prairie times, it was months between those two events. And of course, greatly flattened out, greatly smoothed out. So Neal Street then became, because the railroad goes through, puts in a big pipe under the railroad, but at, coming off of Hessel Park in that area, the water couldn't get under the tracks fast enough, formed Lake Neal on the street for years.
Yes.
The city finally does something about it. They put 2 5-by-5 culverts under Neal Street, turned down Green Street, dumped it in the Boneyard. All they did was move Lake Neal to the campus. And everybody was telling them at the time, you're going to just flood out the campus now. And that's when the water skiing on the campus started. And so what they did finally then is build this detention basin. We were suggesting that in the beginning. You take Lake Neal, you got to put it somewhere, put it in a hole in the ground where that Healy Street detention is now, right? Well, about 30 years later, they put the detention basin in, thanks to Dan McCollum. And then the one we have now between 1st and 2nd Street and north of Springfield. Yes, Boneyard has been buried and many places, and I thought that was unwise because we could build the detention and live with the stream. They were going to deepen Scott Park to 15 feet deep. The Boneyard runs through Scott Park. I said, no, you can't do that. And then they said, oh, we'll make a detention basin out of Scott Park. No, you can't do that either.
It was a memorial to a previous mayor.
Yeah, and then so we suggested that since you need a drain from the detention basin just upstream of Scott Park, put pipes under the Boneyard and leading off to the new construction of the Boneyard further downstream, and then put the dirt back on, and then you've got a prairie stream that handles very little. Yeah, handles its respective proportion of the flood flows. And so now you don't get these floods gushing through Scott Park. You get them trapped upstream and let go underneath the Boneyard through Scott
Park. It's lower, but it's pumped up into a... So the flow coming from through Scott Park is relatively natural.
Yes, that's right. And then there's a little waterfall at the end of Scott Park dropping back into the deepened channel. And that's that part of the Boneyard then is buried from that point, which is First Street to Wright Street.
Yes.
Yeah, it's buried. And then the campus tried to do something well there, and they buried part of it, but most of the engineering part is open. And then now Urbana has done something over on Ray Street, which is concrete heavy, in my opinion, but it's still... invites people to walk along the Boneyard and so on. The very thing we were talking about in the 60s. So nobody will remember that, but that was an effort for sure.
So this is written up so people, the young folk you're encouraging, can get an access to this information?
Yeah.
Archived in the Urbana Free Library, perhaps?
Probably, yes. Urbana Free Library would have... We called it...
You need a public relations thing.
Yes. I'm trying to think of the organization we had of the students who were doing the pollution
students
measurement.
Environmental concerns?
No, that was before them. Anyway, it doesn't matter. We also had a group of students, these same engineering students and landscape architecture students, build on 4x8 sheets of plywood that represented the Boneyard and what you could do with it if you flattened it out. And built detention and so on. And I think there were about 8 sheets of it that represented the whole Boneyard. And it was just a dream, you know, an idea, but they'd cart it around to the city councils and do this sort of thing.
Well, Well, let's change directions a little bit. The reason why I have you came in the first place was because I went to the Blind Pig and started talking to Scott, and we were talking about clocks. So you have an avocation of clock repair, and that's different from watch repair.
That's
But we've had both here. So
Charles Webster took a picture in the 30s of the tower in Urbana, the courthouse tower. And I ran across it somewhere in the 60s, and actually before that, in the late 50s. And I said, wow, this tower was really elegant in the beginning. Well, it had been hit by lightning three times, reduced in level three times, and it looked like a sawed-off rectangular, something kids would build out of toys. And the bell was down in the courtyard, and the clock wasn't running. So I said, we got to restore the clock, get it going, get the bell back up there, and then to rebuild this tower. So I take this picture of Charles Webster's, and I'd show it to every chairman of the county board for years. And finally, in 1990, Steve Beckett was on the board. And that, or not, no, 2000. And that was the key. He has a deep interest in history. He was on the facilities planning committee. They had just finished a $25 million piece on the
addition to
the courthouse. And now they were going to do some minor work on the old courthouse. And that's where we decided we would, rebuild the tower and redo the clock, and now it works fine. Rings the bell just like it used to.
You raised the money to get there.
Yes, we raised about $1.2 million, something like that, $1.3 million.
So I have a question. As you raise the tower, you do have a lightning strike potential again.
Well, we put on cable. The lightning rods all over the place, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So no more lightning strikes. And here these farmers are running the county board from 1900 on, putting lightning rods on their barns, but not on their courthouse. And it was kind of disjointed.
Well, they used to get struck because if you were on a horse and you were the highest point around in a flat land, you were subject to lightning strike.
Right, you and a horse.
Even cattle would get struck. Mm-hmm. So they had a reason for putting.
Right. So clocks have long been a hobby, and repairing antique mechanical clocks.
Well, yes. We had a person named Hugh Wales, whom I think was a professor in economics.
Yes, that's right.
He was also president of the Watchmakers Union. And he was changing things because apprentices were having to file new pieces of watches, and the watches were coming to town all made, and there was a need for cleaning. And so he had inventions. I can remember he had a place where you put your elbows and your hands could move out and pick up the screwdrivers and the things that you needed. And Hugh Wales was encouraging a small instrument courses at Parkland College. And so that's a different, that's not so much clocks, that's watches.
Yeah.
Do you have other people who are working on?
Yeah, I got four others who are now what we call the, instead of Worshipful Company of Clock Fixers, we are the what was the term we used? Well, anyway, the English had they call it the Guild, Worshipful Company of Clockmakers.
Yes, Guild.
And so we're sort of like that. And there are retired math professor, retired psychology professor, an anesthesiologist, and a regular family doctor. And they're all doing it because they have inherited either inherited large clocks collections or not. One last thing we should talk about is the oak trees.
15 seconds.
Oh, 15 seconds. But I have every year for 40 years grown about 100 bur oak trees, seedlings, and given them away to the area. So it's a my local contribution, my development of karma, if you will.
That so you grow them from seed and then give them away.
Yes, right. And so they grow up. I figure I got a couple thousand Burr Oaks growing out there now.